This is the Medicast, September 21st, 2009.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this week's show officially. You know, we've got a lot of brand new listeners, I can tell, looking at the numbers of downloads and things. And of course, that's thankful to a lot of you for sharing the MedicCast with your colleagues, with your students, with your classmates. It's a great resource, I hope. To try to provide this type of information, news and commentary, tips and everything else in this format so that you can listen, built just for busy EMS providers just like you. So let's keep that going on. Keep spreading the word. If you're a newsletter subscriber, it's quick and easy to just forward that email to a friend or a colleague where we have a topic they might be interested in listening into. And all the information is there for them to go ahead and follow up and sign up for that newsletter or go ahead and listen to the show directly at the website. Of course, you can find the website at medicast.com/blog. The blog is where we have the show notes for all of the episodes. There's a link right there on the page that'll take you right to the show notes section for each episode. And you can check out this and all the episodes, links to all the tip information, follow-up resources, as well as additional information on all of the news information we talk about, the links for all those articles. All of that's available in the show notes each and every week. Of course, don't forget, you can get back in touch with us directly here. Contact me at email, podmedic@mac.com, podmedic@mac.com. You can also call into the voicemail line, 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. And of course, don't forget, you can always leave comments right over on the MedicCast blog. Click on the link right there at the top for comments, and you can share your comments directly with everybody on the site. It's a great way to contribute to the community aspect of the show. Also, please remember that you can also reach me on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for Podmedic. Jamie Davis, the Podmedic is available at facebook.com/podmedic or twitter.com/podmedic. And I love to hear from all of you, however it is you contact me. And speaking of contacting me, a lot of you that follow me over at Facebook or have listened to what I've been doing different places this week realize that my wife was in the hospital starting Sunday night. She actually had multiple pulmonary emboli. We are very, very lucky. It gives me chills to think about how close things were. She had some shortness of breath, chest pain, didn't want to go to the hospital or be a pain to anybody. You know, we've all run into patients like that. I did convince her to go by car, and then, of course, I drove her right over to the firehouse and got her in an ambulance, but at least she didn't have the ambulance come to the house. But this is just something that we might need to review here on the show, reviewing pulmonary embolism, blood clots, and how they form, where they go to, and the treatments for those types of things. So look for that in a future episode. But I just wanted to thank everybody for the comments and well wishes for my family. As those of you that were following me on Twitter or on Facebook kind of got a running rundown of what we were doing, starting in the trip to the emergency room and then following up with the physician's diagnosis of what was actually going on and then the admission and stuff. So we've gotten things squared away. She's back home and going to have a little bit of a course of treatment ahead of her, but she's out of the woods, I think, for the most part, and I do want to thank everybody for their kind thoughts and prayers. Let's get in onto the regular email. I got an email in from a listener, John. John was checking in with a question. He had an interesting case he wanted to kind of review and get some information from me on, and this was a patient with an extremely low heart rate. She had a difficulty breathing primary complaint, but when they looked at her vitals, aside from the decreased heart rate, all other vitals were pretty normal. They took the patient to the hospital. Talking to the ER nurse, the ER nurse relayed to them that the patient had an amiodarone toxicity issue. Looking up amiodarone toxicity, couldn't find anything about this particular presentation, only a pulmonary relationship of the toxicity. But I'll just, you know, let's look at what amiodarone does, John, and for everybody else. We need to remember that medications have basically intentional poisonings of the body. Any medicine we give has some risk factor. Anything we do can have a negative effect in the wrong dose. Usually that dose is a too high dose, but in, you know, there's a therapeutic range for every medication, and anything outside of that range is either going to be not enough to have any effect or have way too much of whatever effect it's supposed to have. If you think about any antiarrhythmic medication, its job is to, in some way, suppress the conduction system of the heart and suppress the ability of the heart to continue to propagate whatever rhythm is going on right now. We look at medications like lidocaine. It's basically a topical anesthetic. You know, I mean, lidocaine's used as a numbing agent for, you know, outpatient surgeries. So we think about these things looking at something like amiodarone. It has a more specific effect on the cellular aspects of cardiac conduction and transmission, but it certainly is also an antiarrhythmic, and it's going to suppress rhythm, which means it can cause some depression of just depression of the heart rate, depending on what kind of cardiac rhythm the patient normally has. Obviously, this patient has been prescribed amiodarone, perhaps for something like an AFib or something similar, and this is something that they take regularly. As they may have taken too much of the drug for some reason, or something's changed in their diet or in their lifestyle that has altered the way the drug is working in their body, this is something that can happen. And just think about the fact that an antiarrhythmic or any medication can have unintended effects related to its primary source of action. And this is something that you can see in any medication. You know, you can see patients, you give D50 to a patient. If you give D50 to a patient and take their blood sugar and it's, 200 something, well, obviously you gave D50 in a situation where they must have had too much sugar on board. Either your blood glucose monitor didn't work the first time you used it, or God forbid you didn't even check their blood sugar. Again, you just see an unintended consequence that's related to the normal course of action of this medication. Hope that answers you. That's kind of my take on what you relayed to me in that email. And of course, I'll always send you an email back as well directly to give you my answer too. But John, thanks for the email, and I look forward to hearing from you more. I also got an email in from listener Jared, checking in to just drop me a line real quick, say that I'm doing a really good job with the podcast. He's a certified field medic with the military up until a few years back, now looking to work on his civilian certification in the state of California. Podcasts really help him along with that process. So I just wanted to let you guys know that I really appreciate it when I get an email like this, and I really enjoy reading them. It helps me get through a hard week like I've had this past week to encourage me to go out and continue putting together good shows for you guys. Keep the ideas coming, and keep the comments coming in. Let me know what you like and what you don't like. I know some of you don't like commercials in the podcast. I put together a commercial-free version of the podcast for you, those of you that are interested in it, so you have that. But obviously, it helps to pay the freight on the equipment I buy to keep the studio up and running here in my house, and to help support my travels when I go to conferences and things like that. You know, all of that comes from the advertising revenue, and you know, I'm not getting rich off the Medicast, but I am certainly able to support what I can do here, and that's something that I enjoy doing every single week. And so Jared, thank you very much for the email, and you know, keep listening to the show, and keep the ideas and suggestions coming in. Let's jump on into this week's news, and I'm going to lead off with a story I found over at medicalnewstoday.com, and I always try to keep an eye on new cardiac information about detection of cardiac problems, especially myocardial infarctions. We need to understand how these types of things, including laboratory results that we don't use in the field, but we need to understand how they work. I don't think it's going to be that long before we have some kind of detection kit for cardiac markers that we can find in the blood and quickly diagnose the presence of an MI in absence of any ST elevation or ST changes in the 12 leads. This is something that needs to be done so we can better diagnose cardiac patients and take them to the appropriate facilities without overloading those facilities with patients who may not be having MIs, or taking patients who don't definitively have an MI to the wrong facility because we can't say that they're having one. So as the technology develops to find new markers that show earlier in blood work, I think we're moving closer to the point when we're going to have some kind of a handheld device like we use for diabetic patients, some kind of like a glucose monitor. We'll have some kind of a cardiac marker detection kit, and we'll use that to detect the presence of some of these cardiac markers. The problem up to date in many cases has been that the typical cardiac markers, the troponin I and troponin T, sometimes take up to 3 hours to develop a significant level in the bloodstream that can be detected by the current tests. The two new markers mentioned in this particular article, the sensitive cardiac troponin assay and the copeptin marker, are both pretty definitive in detecting the presence of an MI. In fact, when they both are positive, they are 99% predictive of the presence of a myocardial infarction. So if we have something, you know, we put somebody on a 12 lead, we're going to be starting IVs anyway on these patients. We get a blood draw and we can do a quick test. Even if we don't see ST elevation on the cardiac monitor, we can use this test to go beyond that. We see ST elevation and this test is positive too. Well, guess what? You know, then it's not 99%, it's probably 100% predictive. But it's something that we can really use, I think, once they can bring these things into the field and give us the ability to use something like this, just like we use a glucose monitor. It's something I think is going to take some time in coming. There's obviously development of the miniaturized technology is still on the way, but you know, I think probably maybe 5 to 10 years down the road, this is something that we'll have in the back of our units to help diagnose patients in the field and make sure that we're not bringing the wrong patient to the wrong facility. Next up, another follow-up item for the investigation into the rash of medical helicopter crashes that occurred last year and earlier this year. And the National Transportation Safety Board has released some additional findings urging the government to impose stricter controls on emergency helicopter operators. This doesn't mean the pilots, although it will filter down to the pilots. This means the companies or organizations that own these helicopters so that there can be more information on how and when they should use certain types of systems, what types of systems should be on the helicopters themselves and available to the pilots. And this includes the use of things like autopilot, night vision systems, flight data recorders that can help to alleviate future tragedies when something bad does happen. And of course, using autopilot and night vision systems to assist in the flight of a patient or the crew in bad situations or at nighttime. This is something that we're going to have to continue to review, but it's something I and many other people have been calling for, is that there needs to be some stricter controls. A lot of times, and we know this is true, we can get away with doing things without having to follow the rest of the laws that everybody else have to follow just by saying we're emergency services. We need to have a waiver on this. And we use that when we drive on the highway. Obviously, we still need to take due regard, but we are, after we have stopped and made sure traffic is clear, we are allowed to go through a traffic light that's a red light rather than just waiting until it changes to green. And we are allowed to make cars pull over and drive faster than the posted speed limit. All of these things are part of what emergency services use to enable us to do our jobs, but at the risk of being unsafe for providers, patients, and the public in general, that's when we start to see problems. And a lot of times organizations, and many times for-profit medical organizations, will use this emergency services blanket to mean that they don't have to spend additional money on certain safety systems. It's been a problem, and I hope that this particular report is going to enable the federal government to have stricter controls over this type of transport here in the United States. So next up is an interesting story. I picked this up over at emsresponder.com, and it is the Renton, Washington fire chief talking about the future of the fire service. Fire departments that respond only to fires are expected to cease to exist in just a few generations. This is from an International Association of Fire Chiefs official, David Daniels. He's a fire chief from Renton, Washington, and he presented this information at the Fire Rescue International Conference earlier this past month. And he said basically that they are going to have to grow with other agencies and organizations, and that if they want to continue to have the funding they need to provide the services they need to get into the EMS business. This is something that is interesting and also alarming in some respects. Obviously, there's a conflict in many places between fire and EMS when you have them inside the same service. Oftentimes, EMS is seen as a stepping stone towards the quote-unquote cushier fire service jobs. And of course, that means that your most experienced providers, the ones who've had the most time on the street or around patient care, are not on your ambulances. And that causes a lot of issues, especially when your supervisory staff is most often people that are not actively involved in patient care either. This is interesting to see that the fire chiefs are seeing this as a revenue source, not necessarily as an additional service that they want to provide, that they're just seeing this as a way to bring additional budgetary dollars in so they can buy more fire equipment. This is alarming in that respect, and I'm hoping that if fire services are taking this to heart, that they are embracing the fact that patient care goes along with that job, and that you just can't go ahead and bill for services and not provide good quality patient care or have a service that is not focused on EMS as a patient care job. Now, this next report in the news, the final article, actually comes from the International Association of Fire Chiefs meeting as well, talking about the fact that fire departments and EMS services around the country, some of them have turned to providing non-emergency transport services to make additional money. And so not just taking the 911 calls, but bringing on additional medics and units to go ahead and provide interfacility and other non-emergency transport services as a way to make ends meet. And of course, this will cut into a lot of the private ambulance services out there that might be operating in the same region if that primary emergency service is also, you know, a state-based or state partially funded organization like many are, then you run into a big conflict of interest. And, you know, you got tax dollars paying for parts of units, and you can have a better unit and a better paid staff, perhaps. This can cause a lot of issues. I'm interested to see how these things shake out. But it's interesting in this economy where money is being taken out of public safety budgets. Fire, police, and EMS budgets are going down as a way to try to close the budget gap from the economy issues that we're having. This is something that we're likely to see more of. And I'm curious if you guys have seen something like this in your services. Have you seen this type of cross-pollination going on in your service where things are changing, where they're looking for revenue streams rather than just continuing to provide services as they have all the time? It's an interesting juxtaposition because many agencies or nonprofit or state-funded organizations, they don't usually think about revenue stream, but this seems to be a shift or a paradigm shift in the way that they're looking at things. Time to jump on into this week's tip of the week, and we are joined again this week by our good friend Lisa Booz in an interview we recorded a couple months ago, but I do these segments ahead so that I can save her some time than having to call in every month. But this is one of the ones I've been looking forward to, really looking forward to talking about poisoning myths. You know, there's a lot of internet myths and hoaxes that get passed around and get revived and recirculated, and people just accept them as true. And you might run into some of these as you deal with your patients. Heck, you might believe some of them yourself. So Lisa's joined us to talk about these types of common poisoning myths and to set us straight with the good information she always provides. Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're back again. Lisa Booze is here with some more great poisoning information for us and overdoses and toxicology from the Maryland Poison Center at mdpoison.com. And Lisa, what do you have for us this month?
Well, Jamie, I thought we'd have a little bit of fun this month and talk about some poison myths. Every now and then, our poison specialists at our center, and I'm sure at other poison centers, receive phone calls from frantic parents or grandparents or pet owners that are very concerned about something that they've read over the internet or over an email. Sometimes this information has been passed down over the years. Sometimes it's new information. Sometimes it's recycled information. It's been around, and then it goes away for a few years, and then it comes back again. So in case your listeners come upon patients who are concerned about these rumors, I'll take a few minutes just to tell you about some of these common myths. The myth that's generated the most calls to our poison center recently was contained in an email that's been circulating on and off for a few years and seems to be coming back again. It's about a child who licked her hand after hand sanitizer gel was applied, and supposedly the child developed serious alcohol toxicity. Now, most hand sanitizers contain varying amounts of concentration, or varying concentrations, rather, of ethanol, and the most commonly used products that we buy in the stores contain ethanol somewhere in the range of about 60 to 65%. While these products can be harmful if children ingest them in large quantities, such as in the case of maybe a toddler unscrews the cap and drinks directly from the bottle, they're safe when they're used in the correct amount and in the correct manner. Thousands of exposures are reported to poison centers each year. About 80% of those occur in small children, and almost all of the children remain asymptomatic or maybe develop mild symptoms such as oral irritation and gastric upset. So, how much hand sanitizer would be dangerous? Well, a child would have to drink at least 4 to 5 teaspoons full of most hand sanitizers to produce toxic effects requiring medical attention, and that's a conservative estimate. Most hand sanitizer pumps dispense only about 1/2 teaspoonful of liquid, so clearly more than a lick off of the hands would be required for toxicity. And most would agree that the benefits of using hand sanitizers outweigh the risks, even when they're used in facilities such as schools or other facilities where there are small children or people who might be prone to licking their hands after the product is used. Now, another email that has worried parents of small children and pet owners describes dogs and cats who died from liver failure after walking on floors cleaned with a popular cleaner called Swiffer Wet Jet. The email states that the floor cleaner contains antifreeze. An alternate but similar email says that the same cleaner contains transmission fluid. Both are incorrect, and neither of these chemicals would cause liver failure even if they were in the cleaner. Swiffer Wet Jet would not be expected to produce serious toxicity just by getting it on the skin. Another alternate email is very similar, but it includes the notation that the substance was Febreze fabric freshener that caused serious toxicity. And there again, that's false and just a rumor. Still another email hoax warns that children have become blind after rubbing waterproof sunscreen into their eyes. It even states that there's no way to get the sunscreen out of the eye since it's waterproof. Now, this is far from the truth. Irrigation should always be done for an eye exposure to a product, and there's been nothing in the medical literature to support the claim that sunscreen has caused blindness or really anything more than just some eye irritation. People have called poison centers concerned when their children have handled magic erasers, such as Mr. Clean, those white sponge-like pads that remove dirt and marks from surfaces without using any cleaning agents. An email was going around that stated that they contained formaldehyde. But in fact, this is really untrue and they're non-toxic. They have caused some irritation and burning when the skin was rubbed vigorously with the pad, but that's just due to the rubbing of the pad and not due to any chemicals that are in the pads. An old myth that's been around for decades is that poinsettias are toxic. There was a case way back in 1919 of a child who died after eating a few leaves from a poinsettia plant. But in reality, the death was never proven to be from the plant, and studies have shown that poinsettias are not toxic when ingested. At most, they'll produce maybe some nausea and vomiting when large amounts are ingested and some skin irritation from exposure to the sap that are in the leaves. Now, here's some other common myths. many people think that herbal and natural remedies are completely safe to use, but actually they don't have to meet the same safety and efficacy requirements that drugs do. Many herbals have been found to produce toxicity, and many products, especially those sold over the internet, have been found to contain contaminants that are toxic. So to avoid problems, herbals and supplements should only be used after talking with a doctor or pharmacist, and only purchase well-known brands. Next, many people believe that small children won't eat something that tastes bad, things like perfumes or cleaners or even bitter-tasting pills. Now, we all know that isn't true. That hasn't stopped some children from eating poisonous substances in pretty significant amounts. So it should never be assumed that a child has not eaten something because of the taste. If someone has been poisoned, another myth is to call 911 immediately. Most poisonings do not require medical treatment. Poison center specialists handle more than 70% of calls to the poison center at the home or on site without medical treatment and just with advice from the poison specialist. Unless the patient's unconscious or seizing or has other serious effects, the local poison center should be called instead of 911. In many areas of the country, 911 systems reroute callers to the poison center instead of dispatching EMS. And then if the poison specialist makes the assessment that EMS transport is needed, that will be relayed to the caller and also to the dispatcher. Another myth is that children cannot open childproof containers. If those caps really were completely childproof, you or I or nobody out there would be able to open them. Those closures do make it difficult for children to open, and they have decreased the number of poisonings and fatalities by a pretty large quantity, a pretty large amount in small children. But some children will get them open. So we don't like to call them childproof. We like to refer to them as child resistant. And now for fun, here are a few more myths that really I don't think I need to explain in any way. Calvin Coolidge's son died due to a poisonous dye in his black socks. Another myth was that terrorists added anthrax and arsenic to one out of every five Coca-Cola cans. Gang members all over the country are spreading LSD and strychnine on payphone buttons. And people have been killed by licking cyanide-laced ATM machine deposit slips. Now, as you can see, false rumors spread quickly, especially in this day and age of the internet and email. And many of them, it's sort of common sense that they aren't true, but some of these, it does cause a great concern in parents and pet owners. So it's important for healthcare providers to call the poison center for verification if you're confronted with a patient that's concerned because of an email or some sort of rumor.
Well, Lisa, you know, it's funny, and I'm always amazed at the things that people believe and that come out of a patient's mouth when they're talking about a situation that they're dealing with. And one of the things I think we need to remember is that their lack of education doesn't mean that they're necessarily wrong, that may be something else going on. But we need to educate the public about resources like the poison centers to help take care of these patients and give them a resource they can call to not call 911. And I think it's great that you demonstrated the 70% number is just amazing. Really can take a load off a local jurisdiction just by educating your public a little bit more about poison centers.
Well, that's one of the objectives of poison centers. Obviously, it's to save lives and save people from becoming ill from poisons, but also to save money and save healthcare resources. And I think poison centers do that very well. So we do try to get the word out to the public and also to EMS systems, you know, throughout the country that we are available 24/7 to call if something happens. And the poison specialist will offer advice to the patient, and in many cases will call back once, twice, or even more often just to make sure that the patient is okay and that any treatment that we've recommended has been done appropriately.
Well, Lisa, and that number again is?
It's 1-800-222-1222, and that will connect you to the local poison center for where you're calling from.
Great. Lisa, thanks a lot. We'll look forward to hearing from you again soon.
I'll talk to you soon, Jamie. Thanks.
I want to thank Lisa Booz again from the Maryland Poison Center for joining us. You can find out more and subscribe to their email newsletter, Tox Tidbits newsletter, over at mdpoison.com. You don't have to be from the state of Maryland to get this great information from Lisa and the other great experts over at the Maryland Poison Center. You can just go over there directly and sign up. Again, mdpoison.com. And I want to thank Lisa again for checking in here and sharing this information with us. And I'll be recording some new segments for the coming months in just a couple of weeks with Lisa. So we'll look forward to a lot more from her here in the near future. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show and remind you, go over to MedicCast.com/blog, MedicCast.com/blog, where you will find a link for the show notes for this and every other episode. It's really important that you follow up on the information you hear about here, both the articles in the news, as well as the tips and medical information you hear in the tip of the week. We try to provide lots of additional articles and links and resources for you to follow up on. We can only provide some basic information here on the show. It's your job to take that information along with the additional resources and figure out how they apply to your specific scope of practice and your own protocols in your region. So make sure you do that. Don't forget to get back in touch with us with your comments, your tips, your suggestions, corrections even. We want to hear from you. It's great to hear from the listeners all the time. Of course, you can leave comments over on any of the articles and information at the website. And also sending in email, emails to podmedic@mac.com, podmedic@mac.com, or call in on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. All of that's a great way to get in touch with me here. And, you know, if you haven't been over to the website recently, you really should check out the excellent articles. We have an intern and a couple of interns that are helping out with some different projects. And one of them, our intern Leanne, she is writing some amazing articles over there. So if you really want to read some good stuff and information and takes on different things, reviews of products and articles, check out what Leanne's doing over at the MedicCast site. She's putting up a couple of articles every single week. And, you know, let her know how you like them. Leave a comment on them when you get over there. Time to wrap up this week's episode with some music from the PodSafe Music Network. This week, a brand new artist and song to the MedicCast community. This is Samuel Ventura with his song Strawberry Soda. If you like what you hear, you'll find a link to his songs in the show notes, his site over there, as well as a link to purchase his music directly at the iTunes store. So it's a great way to support these artists, spend 99 cents, purchase their song, and let them know you appreciate them sharing their songs here with podcasts like the MedicCast. That's it for me. I will close out the show and remind you that I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. And don't forget, folks, scene safety, BSI.
Pick a star from the big and black sky. Make a wish, but don't aim too high. Expectations leave you waiting round. I've been waiting, being pretty patient. Known invitations, pouring champagne. And this girl's gonna make me lose my mind. And then I wrote her, told her to come over. We'll drink Coca-Cola, strawberry soda. And we'll talk about our stupid lives. My life's been exactly how my night's been. A little lonely, but I feel alright when I get around to pouring myself a drink. Na 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 na. Well, I've got a feeling today is gonna be alright. Na 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 na. Well, I've got a feeling something's gonna be a little different high. I'm always waiting on dreams to come true. And if you miss me, come over here and kiss me. Or just wish me good luck and whiskey. Either way, things aren't looking too bad. Lemonade stands, you always gotta make plans. When it's hard to stand, I hold your tiny hands. Tell you how much you mean to me. Lemonade stands, you always gotta make plans. When it's hard to stand, I hold your tiny hands. Tell you how much you mean. Na 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 na
rich but don't aim too high. Expectations leave you waiting round and then a rotor. Told her to come over, we'll drink Coca-Cola,
strawberry soda.
We'll talk about our stupid minds. But don't aim too high. Nothing ever seems to go my way.